I'm excited for today's guest. I really like Nick.
Oh, yeah, he's a great bloke.
While we often speak the same language as Nick, he's a little harder to understand, can I just say? Our friend Nick McCalmont Woods, owner and broker of McCalmont Woods Real Estate, is located in
London, England.
Great Britain. My favorite story of his, well, we'll get into that, in the podcast
later. I'm Bob Gibbons.
I'm Jan Gibbons. And on today's episode of the Confessions of Recovering Landlord podcast, you're going to understand why we like Nick so well. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jan.
Tickled you're here with us today. Tell us a little bit about you and your company.
Oh, well, I am the CEO of a company called McCalmont Woods Real Estate LLP. And we are exclusive tenant rep brokers in your language, based in London. And we've been operating for 15 years now, since we first set up back in 2008.
What were you doing before that?
Before that, I started off at Jones Lang Wootton back in 1984, which is 37 years ago. It's a long time, isn't it?
That's the year I got in the business.
Yeah.
I'm here with these two old guys.
I used to have a lot more hair then as well.
I hope I can relate.
Yeah, so I was with Jones Lang in London for 16 years. And then, after the merger, 2 years after the merger with LaSalle, I went to head up a mid-size practice in the city. And I stayed with them for 7 years. And then they were bought out, and that was the opportunity for me to set up my own shop, which I've done ever since.
Nice.
Kind of want to go ahead and just delve right into the dark side. Tell our listeners how we all met.
Well, I remember it very well. January 2017, Los Angeles. First time I'd ever been to the West Coast of America.
And you meet us. What a disappointment.
No, it was fantastic. You know, I'd written this article back in 2016 on conflicts of interest. And one of our colleagues, Walt Botansky in Tampa, had read it. And I mentioned it to ATR, so Alliance of Tenant Representatives. And that resulted in an interview with Eric Burson, chairman of ATR. And ultimately, an invitation to join ATR. But I'm old school, and so as with most sensible folks, I like to meet people before I do any business with them. So that was an opportunity, frankly, to hop on a plane, sunny California, and come and meet all these really highly successful, independent, business owners of what I call mini me's. So people who specialize in tenant rep. And of course, the other thing is it's always very cold and wet in London. So any opportunity to a bit of sunshine is very welcome.
Well, I have to reminisce about something you told me that night we met at dinner that just I've told everyone I've ever met, and everyone have equally loved it. Tell us about how you were talking about our then president, Donald Trump's slogan of MAGA, Make America Great Again. And you told me something. Relate that story.
Well, I think we'd seen all these slogans over here, and then sudden wit came up with the idea of sort of Make America Great Britain Again.
I just love that.
I can vouch for the fact that Jan has shared this with everybody she's met since that day. Well, I've heard that story through her so many times.
I fell for it. He goes, "You left out a word." And I'm like, what?
It was just so perfect.
So perfect.
Well, I thought it was hilarious because when you walked into the ATR meeting in your top hat and tails, carrying your cane, had your little monocle, you know, you definitely stood out from the Americans that were so casual. And you know,
I was definitely the only one wearing a tie, wasn't I?
Yeah.
A suit.
Showed up with a tie. I was like, who is this guy? Then you spoke and it cleared it all up.
But you noticed he gravitated to the redneck, so he's okay.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, yeah. I actually got a lot of Texan friends.
The blonde redneck at dinner, that wasn't too hard to figure out, regardless of where she was from. Well,
too kind, sir.
So one thing I've always thought was funny is, I'm not sure what it is about the Brits and their hyphenations, but your last name is McCalmont Woods, hyphenated.
Yeah.
What is it about hyphenating? I mean, I know so many Britons that have hyphenating in their last name.
I don't know, but I would never use it at school because coming from Liverpool, if you had a hyphenated name, you know, at the time I was going to school, you're probably likely to be beaten up. So I was just Nick Woods at school.
But, so why was that? Was that considered, is the hyphenation considered a uppity thing or what?
I think people might think it's a bit posh, but who knows? I don't know. There's just lots of people who got hyphenated names.
Cracks me up. Well, thank you for being our guest on the show today. So I guess the first thing I kind of wanted to talk about was really just sort of how are things done differently in the UK versus the US? And, you know, even within the US, you know, within the commercial real estate business, the way we do things here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas is not the same as what they do in Chicago or Seattle or Atlanta necessarily. I mean, generally, it's probably pretty close. But, you know, as we've talked over the years, there's a few things about the UK system that still sort of harkens back to what sounds like the feudal times where you had the property owners and the tenants, the serfs, if you will. And so, you know, one of the things you've talked about is just the length of the leases. You know, we're used to 5, maybe 10 year lengths of leases here, but over there, historically, you've done what, 25 year leases, something like that?
Certainly, when I started out, 25 year leases was the norm. I'll just sort of digress and tell you that when I started my home business back in 2008, the first job I had to deal with was for an old client of mine, which was J.P. Morgan Cazenove. And this was a sort of 8,000-9,000 square foot office building right next to the Bank of England, literally right next to the Bank of England. And that lease was a 99-year lease.
Wow.
So when I got my hands on it, there was 57 years remaining on the lease.
Oh, my gosh.
And the base rent was reviewed every 10 years, and then it would switch to 11 years, and then it would switch back to 10 years. And when you had to set the rent, you had to disregard what we call tenant improvements. So this building was, you know, originally was constructed in the 1890s. By the time the client, which was Cazenove, the Queen stockbroker, was dealing with it, they'd air conditioned the building, they put a lift into the building. And all of those improvements had to be taken into account when you were valuing the building. It was an absolute nightmare because there's no such comparable. You can't find any comparables to try and value that because at the time, leases had moved away from the 25-year pattern back to effectively where they are today, which is really 10 years with, in the main, 5-year break options. If you had a large property today, Bob Jan, and that property required, you know, significant capital expenditure, you'd probably end up with a 15-year lease. Or if you were pre-letting a new building, you'd probably be taking a 25-year lease, you know, to justify the construction cost. But in the main, you know, most people would probably be looking at a 10-year term with a 5-year break.
So a break is kind of like the, like a termination option in our case. Like, yeah, if we did exactly. a 10-year deal and we had the option to terminate after 5 years, that's what a break is.
Yes. Yes. Except, you know, in the UK, you actually have to serve notice to bring, to exercise that break. And if you don't actually serve a notice, then, you know, the lease will just continue through to its end date.
And that's the same way here. If we have an option to terminate, then you have to give a certain amount of notice prior to the effective date of that. So typically it's going to be like a 12-month notice. For a smaller tenant, it might be a shorter period of time. But on the deal where you're doing a 15 or 20-year, 25-year lease term, you use something where you reset the rent. What's that about?
So when the lease is originally granted, it's granted at the base rent. And then in the UK leases, so well, I should just preface this and say that my comments are all about England and Wales, because as I think, you know, when we talked about Brexit previously, anything which involves the four countries which make up the UK just becomes incredibly complicated. And so Scotland and Northern Ireland have got slightly different leases to England and Wales. So all my comments are based on the situation in England and Wales, because that's where my firm has legal jurisdiction and where we operate. So so if you take a sort of 15, 20-year lease, every 5 years, there's normally what we call an upward-only rent review. And that is effectively designed to allow the landlord to ratchet up the initial base rent to adjust for inflation. Okay? And those longer term leases were originally granted effectively to give the tenants more favorable terms with a longer security. So you can imagine that whatever rent you pay today isn't going to be the same in 25 years' time. So every five, it used to be every 7 years. And then I think at some point in time, they may be reduced to 3 years, but they found a sort of natural level. Every 5 years, the rent is reviewable.
So if there's a 15-year lease, the tenant is committed to the 15 years.
Yes.
But then every 5 years, the rent is then adjusted up based on whatever the market conditions are at the time.
Yeah, and it can't go down. So the rent, and this is sort of an anachronism of the UK market, that when you take your lease, depending on what the market's doing at the time, you know, if you took a lease at the height of the market and then 5 years later the market tanked, you're still paying, you know, a sort of super high rent for the next 10 years. And it can't go down. So yes. think about if you wanted to exit that lease or sell it, assign it, sublet it, it might be a bit of a problem.
So, but if you're in a 5 year period, let's say you've done the 15 year deal, but you're in the first 5 year, is the rent flat fixed for that 5 year period, or does it have steps throughout that first 5 year period?
It's fixed.
It's fixed. Okay. So in Texas, normally we're going to see bumps every single year, whether that's 50 cents a square foot, 75 cents a square foot, or a percentage, 2-4% per year. So you'll normally see that escalate throughout the initial term of the lease. Then you have a renewal option for the next 5 years or the next 7 years or the next 10 years, depending on how long the initial term was. But then it's an option at that point. You know, you're not required to stay there for the next 5 years. It's your option as the tenant to say, yes, I want to stay or I don't want to stay. And yeah, the renewal option will say that the rent can't be any less than what it had been in the prior 5 year term, but that's only if you exercise the option. And so we always advocate you never renew your lease, meaning never exercise your renewal option. You renegotiate. So we can go renegotiate. In fact, we just are about to sign a lease amendment with a client where They had 66,000 square feet. They have an option to extend their lease, but it says the rent can't be any lower. So we just went to the landlord 6 months before the date they had to give notice on their renewal option and said, all right, we want to negotiate a new lease term, but we want improvements. We want free rent. We want, you know, now this is during COVID. So, you know, we wanted everything, right? And we got everything. But, and so we basically negotiated outside the renewal option. But in your case, the only opportunity for that is at the end of the 15-year term, not at each 5-year period.
That's right.
Sounds like. Okay.
But there's another difference as well, which is, I think, between the US model and the UK model, is that in the UK, the occupier is responsible for the fit out generally. So if you take what we call Cat A offices, so that's where the landlord builds the office space to a developer's finish. So you've got your, you know, shiny new raised floors and your ceiling in and the lighting in, but the tenant has to come in, flood wire the space, build all the partitions, you know, carpet the space, introduce whatever other technology and fittings it wants, like kitchens, etc., all that type of stuff. The tenant pays for that. And then at lease expiry, whether that be the operation of a break clause or the natural lease expiry, it's the tenant's responsibility to strip it all out.
Mm-hmm. Put it back
and return the space back to its Cat A condition that the tenant first leased it in. So you can see why, you know, in this instance, you don't really want to be moving every sort of 2, 3, 4, 5 years, because you've actually invested quite a lot of money into your office space.
I mean, do the landlords not see that there's value in those improvements already in the space? I mean, why wouldn't they want to leave those improvements instead of having them tear it out?
I mean, you know, it used to be that, no, when the lease expired, the tenant, the landlord would say, strip it all out, give the space back to me as it was originally leased, because occupiers couldn't really see any benefit or merit in taking somebody's secondhand fit out. And you know, a lot of people used to say, well, it's a false economy, because actually, by the time I sort of adjust this fit out to suit my own style of operation, it would have been better and quicker and easier for me to have taken landlord space day one. But obviously, with the sort of the environment we're all working in now, more sustainable environment, more green in terms of its credentials, there's a lot more instances of existing fit outs being left in situ. But you know, that then raises this whole issue of what are you taking as an occupier? Excuse me a minute. Because there's a real difference between taking landlord space and taking, you know, secondhand space, what you call tenant release space.
Yeah, second generation already built out versus first generation, which is what you're calling landlord space, meaning it's the first time it's being leased.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nick, I had a question. We have been struggling, obviously, as the whole world has been for the last year, 15 months with COVID. Mm-hmm. How has that affected leases, rent relief, any type of governmental rules on what landlords can and can't do with tenants who can't pay, that kind of thing?
I think that's a good question, though, Jan. I think the way I'd answer that is to say that from a business perspective, it's the retail and leisure sectors which have been the hardest hit. I think it's probably fair to say that for the majority of office or service businesses, the impact has not been too great, although they haven't been able to occupy, you know, the space during various lockdowns. And there have been a lot of discussions around lease regears and rent holidays and other concessions. But in the main, you know, most organizations seem to be faring well in the city and other major cities across the UK.
Are you finding office tenants returning to the office now and occupying and working out of there?
Well, we're in our third lockdown at the moment, third national lockdown. And we have been since January. But the good news is all restrictions are due to be ending by the 21st of June. So you're now starting to see people heading back to the office. And I think that that's sort of based on the fact that the vaccination campaign that's been run in the UK has just been so successful. I mean, I think at the moment I'm right in saying something like 70% of all, you know, persons over age 18 and over have had their first dose.
You said 70?
70%.
So wow.
Just under 36 million people. Bearing in mind the population of the UK is 66 million. And I think we're looking at just over 30%, which is 18 million people have had their second dose. So there's a sort of a real feeling of optimism that, you know, by the summer we'll be sort of, you're never going to be COVID free, are you? Let's be honest.
But I mean, that's much higher than in the US. I don't know what I think we're like 30% or maybe 50% of adults.
I heard 50.
Have had their first shot or something like that. But you know, a lot of people here are going back to work already. In Dallas, Fort Worth, for example, we still lead the nation in the highest percentage of people actually showing up to work at about 40%, a little bit more than 40%. And I think that is going to continue going up. We actually went to a baseball game last Sunday. Professional baseball game, and the stadium, we never saw the number, but the stadium holds around 40,000 people, and it was probably 25 to 30,000 people in the stadium.
Wow.
Which just felt so weird because we had gone the day before to take my mother out to lunch at a restaurant, and then took her, she wanted to go to the zoo over in Fort Worth. So we took her to the zoo, and the zoo was crowded with people. So 2 days in a row, we were in these environments where there were lots and lots of people, and few people were wearing masks, and which was very interesting. Now, we've both been fully vaccinated. Our son just got his second vaccination. He went to the baseball game with us. My mom has been fully vaccinated for quite a while.
Our daughter.
Yeah. So, you know, we've all gotten it, but it still felt like such a strange thing to be around so many people.
I think, Bob, that's the key. I mean, my wife and I, we've had our first vaccinations, and we're probably due our second shots beginning of June. But then, you know, you need to allow 2 weeks thereafter, don't you, for it to run its course. So I think, you know, there's going to be a residual nervousness, I think, a residual anxiety until most people have had their second jabs. Because once you've had your second jab, what more can you do? Other than just exercise some common sense about, you know, washing your hands and all that type.
Well,
of stuff.
And in the US, I've only heard of two incidences of people actually dying of COVID after having been vaccinated, and both of them were very elderly people in nursing homes. So, you know, people that are healthy, there's not a single case of somebody getting any serious case of COVID or dying from COVID after having the vaccine. So, you know, that makes you feel pretty good. Well, so there's been an awful lot of discussion here in the US about when people do go back to the office, what's that going to look like? And specifically, there's all this talk about, you know, hybrid and letting employees still work from home, but only come into the office for meetings with clients or group meetings within the organization. How's that being discussed, and what do you expect in the UK?
I think real estate is definitely at a crossroads. I think real estate is going to have to transform. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the pandemic has probably changed the way that people will occupy office space permanently, forever. I really do. I think the hybrid model where effectively people are going to be lending, home working, and office working, is the model that's going to be with us forever now. I think, so many people, I get lots of messages, emails, and LinkedIn messages, all talking and discussing this. And it seems to me that, you know, there seems to be this sort of sense that everybody wants this one-size-fits-all solution that applies to all businesses and across all industries, which is a nonsense. It's just never going to happen, because everybody is going to be doing what is best for them, what's right for them and right for their people. But I do think that in a post-pandemic world, people are going to want the choice, they want the option to be able to work from home or, you know, somewhere else, not necessarily have to go into the office and not necessarily have to spend, you know, two hours on a train going into London or wherever they happen to be working every day. So I honestly think that's the way it's going to work going forward.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm trying to schedule a professional association meeting for next week. And this group has been meeting virtually for the whole time, of course. And a bunch of people wanted to meet in person again. And so I actually just sent out an email this morning asking, all right, who wants to meet in person? You know, we don't want to book this place if, you know, you guys aren't actually going to show up. So I need a show of hands to see how many people are going to actually show up. So I'm anxious to see what that, it's not a big group. It's only maybe 15, 18 people, but I'll be very curious to see how many are willing to show up in person versus not.
Well, you know, I would, but I was talking with a client of mine yesterday, and he raised an interesting issue, which is, what happens if you say to your employees, right, I'd really like you to come back to the office? And in the main, they say, yeah, that's fine. But what happens if somebody says, well, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing this because not everybody in the office has been vaccinated?
Yeah.
I think there are a few issues like that which still need a little bit of working out, because, you know, that's taking you down into employment law territory.
Right. And,
you know, do you force people to come back? Can you force people to come back? Is it legal to force people to come? Is it moral?
Moral and legal.
Yeah, elements of morality, don't they?
Yeah, moral and legal, those aren't the same thing, are they?
I know, yeah.
Nick, we've seen a lot of companies put their space on the sublease market. They've decided that, we actually had a client that had just renewed their lease. And then when COVID hit, they obviously all went home and they closed the office, and they were fairly panicked about it because they said, we can't work remotely. And probably a month in, they were like, we can work remotely. This is mm-hmm. working. So they called us and we ended up subleasing their entire space. Are you seeing that happen on your side of the pond very much?
It's an interesting question, that, Jan. I mean, let me answer it by saying this to you. At the end of 2020, so 1 year after the pandemic had hit the UK shores, the supply in London, available office space in London, was 17 million square feet. That's, in context, that's the highest volume of supply that we've seen since the end of 2009. Now, again, just add a little bit more context. You've got 17 million square feet. Majority of that is now being fueled by tenant release space. But on average, if you look at the 10-year average of take-up of office space in London, it's running around about 10 million square foot per annum. And of course, again, at the end of 2020, that tanked, and only, I think it was, 4.7, just under 5 million square feet of space was taken up. So a sort of 50% reduction.
Well, that's great. I mean, you actually had 4.5 million square feet of new space leased that hadn't been leased in the prior year?
Not necessarily new space, just space which is leased.
Well, but still, I mean, we call it absorption. So the square footage occupied at the beginning of the year versus the square footage occupied at the end of the year, what's that difference? And so like in Dallas-Fort Worth, we had been running prior to COVID in the 4 to 5 million square feet per year of new occupied space. And I don't mean new in terms of brand new space that was just built. I just mean the difference in occupied square footage was higher, and therefore we had positive absorption. During COVID, we've now had 4 or 5 quarters of negative absorption. So even though we have new buildings being built, there are fewer spaces being occupied because when leases expire, people aren't renewing them. Or if they are renewing them, they're renewing them for smaller space. And we have the problem that Jan mentioned of people putting their space on the sublease market. So the net effect is that our occupancy is falling and the total square footage of space being occupied is falling while our supply is continuing to go up.
So what's your vacancy rate?
About 24%.
Wow.
Yeah, big wow. Wow. I mean, now Dallas-Fort Worth.
I was at 7.
You're at 7 right now?
Well, we were seven at the end of 2020. I mean, again, the 10-year, this, I'm talking about central London here. So,
sure.
I mean, you know, central London is if you look at the three CBDs of the West End, the City and Canary Wharf, we're talking about 200 million square foot office market.
Okay.
And the sort of 10-year average vacancy is about 5%. So by going up to 7 is you know, potentially a 40% increase, isn't it?
That, you know, with really long-term leases, I can see why the impact is less than it would be with shorter-term leases. So in Dallas-Fort Worth, we went from probably 15% vacancy, 16% vacancy prior to COVID, which was actually low. I mean, we never get below 14 or 15% in Dallas-Fort Worth because we have so much land, there's so much new construction. We never get to a single-digit vacancy rates. But still, between the amount of space that has been built new, tenants that have put their space in the sublease market, and the space that people just haven't expanded, and have given back space, it's all had the net effect of increasing vacancy by, you know, nearly 10%, you know, 8%, yeah. Call it. But that also includes space that's leased, but on the sublease market and vacant. So that's the caveat. It's a little bit misleading because if we just look at what percentage is leased, well, that's a much higher percentage that's leased than occupied and available for someone else to come in and sublease.
I think it's probably fair to say across both our markets that some of this tenant release space that's hitting the market will never be let.
Yes.
You know, certainly in London, there are some of the really older space, you know, particularly on the basis that we now have energy performance certificates that effectively it's all to do with the green environment and making everything sustainable, environmentally friendly. You know, the cost of upgrading some of this space is probably quite prohibitive. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of this space is repurposed for alternative uses.
So you're exclusively on the tenant side of the business. So, yeah. You know, we call that tenant rep or tenant representation or corporate real estate services. There's a lot of names for it, I guess. What do you call it there?
The same.
Same. Okay. But I understand there's a little bit of difference in that, you know, here the commission for the tenant's agent is built into the rental rate. And so the check is still written by the landlord to the tenant's agent. So even though my fiduciary is always to the tenant, the check actually gets written by the landlord. But the tenant really pays for it over time in their rental rate. But that's not the way it's done in the UK.
No, I've always found that really confusing about the States, to be honest with you. I think I would say to you is certainly in how it works over here is that landlords and tenants will effectively employ their own consultants, surveyors, advisors, brokers, call them what you will, and they pay them directly. So there is a direct fiduciary responsibility between the client and its advisor. You know, if you're a landlord, you might have one, two, or even three agents working for you on a particular project, depending on how large that scheme or project is. Whereas obviously the tenant over here will only have one. So it's I think it's a lot more straightforward, and I think it's a lot simpler. But, I noticed whenever you email me, you always have at the bottom of your email, you know, we're licensed to do X, Y, and Z in Texas. And I don't know if you're aware, but you don't actually need to be licensed to practice as a, to practice real estate in the UK.
That's amazing.
Now, the reality is, I'm a member of the RICS, which is the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, and that confers upon me what's called chartered surveyor status.
Okay.
And the sort of traditional route into the profession is you go to college, university, you do a 3-year degree course, Bachelor of Science, and then when you've achieved your degree, you then go work for a company. And 2 years later, after you've got on-site training and experience, the RICS will grant you your letters, and you can put, MRICS, member of the RICS, after your name, and that confers upon you your professional status. That's how most people used to enter the profession. A lot of people don't even bother with that now. They just set up and say, hey, I'm here, I'm a trader. And you think about all the people who are sort of trading online now. We've had this sort of spate of online agents just appearing out of nowhere. But, and this is a big but, if you carry on business in the UK as an estate agent, you are legally obliged to register with HMRC, which is Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, because that's how the government can keep a very close eye on anti-money laundering and terrorist financing activities. So in monopoly speak, if you do not do that, you will be asked to go to jail very quickly without collecting your $200, passing go and collecting your $200. And that perhaps is the one issue which might sort of help to try and regulate what I regard as the unregulated brokers.
So when you play Monopoly in the UK, is it still in dollars, not in pounds?
No, it's money. I just did that for you.
Oh, you did the conversion for me.
He was accommodating you, sir.
Because the Yanks can't make that conversion very easily. That's hilarious.
I know how much you guys like your Netflix programs. And I was going to say to you that, I think Jan had sort of given me a heads up about trying to explain how the legal structure works over here. And I was just going to sort of try and explain it in the Crown terms, which is basically to say that all land in the UK technically belongs to the Crown.
Oh, that's crazy.
So fundamentally, so the Crown own all the land, and all you do is a landowner just has a right to use and occupy.
So it's a leasehold interest almost.
Well, we've got something called freehold, which just sort of confers absolute ownership. But the reality is, if you were to have nobody to bequeath that to, and so you had this right to use it in perpetuity, but if you had nobody to leave the land or the property to, it will revert to the Crown.
Hmm. And that happens in practice?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, it can do. Yeah, particularly on residential properties and stuff like that.
Wow.
And for example, your personal property, if you were to die, God forbid, and you were to die intestate without a valid will, and you had no living relatives, then your property or estate would all revert to the crown. Anyway, just a little sort of nuance for you.
I want to go back to the tenant rep thing, the fiduciary thing. So I agree with you that I like your system better. I like the fact that you are actually hired by your client and the landlord hires their own agent, and that there's none of this nonsense about who do you represent? Because in Texas, if we don't have a representation agreement that's signed by a client where it clearly says they are engaging us to be their representative, to be their fiduciary, to be their tenant rep, we are legally bound to represent the landlord, even though the landlord has their own agent. Even if the landlord says, yes, I will still pay you. Even if we're pretending like we represent the tenant, we're legally bound to represent the landlord unless we have that agreement with our client, the tenant, that says otherwise. And so we get that agreement all the time. We tell clients why that's important. And that gives us the right to represent them. It does not give us the right to get paid.
That's nuts.
We have to get a commission agreement then with the landlord to get paid. So every engagement requires two separate agreements, one with our tenant to allow us to represent them and one with the landlord to allow us to actually get paid.
Yeah, I think that's nuts. I mean, it used to be when I started off in property in the city of London, back in 84, we used to have what's called the scale. The RICS used to have these authorized charges, professional charges, which we used to call RICS scale fees. And when Margaret Thatcher's government first came into power, there was a Monopolies and Mergers Commission report which scrapped all that in 1977. So once those scale charges were scrapped, anybody who was practicing in real estate could effectively charge the clients what they wanted. And that's the situation that we have today. But what didn't change, as you say, is the relationship between the landlord and the tenant in terms of that direct responsibility. Although, you know, in fairness, we have had a few lost souls try and sort of suggest that we get the landlords to pay the fees. I think that's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, you could argue, couldn't you, that if you were representing an occupier and you put that occupier into a serviced office, the serviced office provider would normally pay the fee. And that's still the case. And that's probably the only instance we have over here where the actual provider of the product pays the fee.
And serviced office being like a Regis or a WeWork or something like that. Yeah. And that's the same way here too. They also pay brokers in those situations, but that's, you know, we don't deal with them a lot. We mostly put clients in direct space, you know, from a landlord for a 5 or a 10 or a 7 year term, whatever it is. So that is interesting. I still do like that system better because I think it's clearer to clients who represents whom. It doesn't require them to really have to think about it. All they have to then think about is, am I going to do this on my own or am I going to hire somebody?
Yeah.
And, you know, commissions are fully negotiable here. And what's interesting is that if you're dealing with a large client, like this 66,000 foot client I mentioned earlier, you know, to get that client, we had to agree to rebate portion of our fee to them. And so the big houses, JLL, Transwestern, CBRE, Cushman & Wakefield, all of those compete with each other. So let's just say IBM wants to put their responsibility, their contract for corporate services out on the market. All these groups will come along, make an argument, make a presentation, and tell IBM, and we will rebate 20% of our fee to you, or 30%, or 40%, or whatever the number is. And so that's how commissions are sort of controlled by the client. because they're really saying, what percentage of your fee are you going to give to me? Because they recognize that they are paying that fee and the rent one way or the other. Yeah. Landlords typically will all kind of conform to the same scheme and agree to the same, you know, percentages, but the tenant then decides how they're going to pay it, so to speak, by how much they're going to get a rebate for.
Well, the first time I ever came across a US broker was about 25 years ago, maybe a bit longer. And I was acting for a major US financial services organization, huge, in London. And the US real estate representative, who was flown in from the States to London and invited his US broker to accompany him as well to get involved in this deal that I was negotiating. And I met this chap in a hotel in Park Lane, and the conversation went, and I won't obviously, I think this guy's still around. So
I want the name. Come on, Nick.
I'm not giving you the name. I'm going to call him Joe.
But that's not his
name. Anyway, so Joe meets me in a hotel in Park Lane, and the conversation goes, "Hi, Nick." I go, "Hi, Joe." He says, "Okay, Nick, what you need to realize is I play tennis with the president of, you know, X bank," which is very nice for you, Joe. "I don't play tennis. I'm a football fan myself." So he says, "Unless you give me half of your fee, this deal's not going to happen." Yeah?
Now,
we're on the same side. We're acting for the same client.
Okay.
And he's basically saying, unless I give him half my fee, he's going to kill the deal. To which I say, well, if I give you half my fee, the deal's not going to happen anyway, because my partners, and I think I might have been an associate, and I don't think I was a full partner. I said, you know, they're not going to sanction this deal. We're not going to act for the client for half the fee. To which he was going, well, you don't understand. You gross your fee up. So effectively, there's a 200% fee, and you give me half. To which I'm saying, well, the deal's still not going to happen, because why would any client, you know, pay twice as much as he needs to in the marketplace? And I was thinking, God, this is a nightmare. You know, this is my first experience of a US broker, and I'm being stitched up by not only the broker, but the client himself from the States. And I think I understand it now, because of what you were saying about he was probably trying to sort of kick back some of his fee to his, you know,
his client,
immediate client in the States. And I was thinking, I don't know, this is a nightmare. How do I deal with this?
And it's fully legal. I mean, there's nothing illegal about giving your client a rebate. What's illegal is giving a portion of your fee to somebody who's not licensed and is not a principal in the deal. That's the illegal part.
But we had no idea, to be honest, sort of how this worked. And so, you know, the way out of it that I found was I basically said to my client in London, I offered to resign the instruction because I didn't want to be the first person to be sued.
Jan, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say the rebate check has to be paid to the name of the entity that signed the lease. So if somebody's like the vice president says, "Hey, I want you to rebate me," the answer is still no. It has to go back to the, like you said, the principal, who is the person that actually signed the lease, the named entity. So that's, I think, what keeps it a little bit more above board.
Yeah. Well, I'm pleased to say that doesn't happen in the UK. So.
Well, yeah,
it would not.
It would be silly, because your client's paying you, and then they take a commission, a cut of that. Just net out the fee. That would make no sense.
So one thing I wanted to talk to you about, Nick, is this new venture you're on, which I'm assuming has come about because of COVID and what we're deeming to be a new hybrid world. But maybe you were working on it before. I've taken a little bit of a look under the hood, as we say, and it looks fascinating. So forgive me while I slaughter this, but talk to me about FIDES Network. Did I get that even close, Fides?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's okay. Perfect. I mean, I think it's really exciting.
Yeah, it looks great.
Fides means trust.
And, I like that.
And it was Fides Network was founded in 2005 by Lord de Morley, who's a British hereditary peer and a former parliamentary undersecretary, together with a small number of handpicked senior business execs. And since inception, Fides has evolved significantly. It used to be very much focused on, if you like, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, but its core purpose remains the same, but it's morphed into a much wider diversity of business sectors. It is, in essence, it's a trusted independent network and referral group, which provides bespoke services and solutions to financial and professional services organizations. Our current chairman is a chap called Mike Symes, who happens to be a freeman of the City of London and also the worshipful company of marketers. But his other claim to fame is that he's a former vice president and head of marketing at Bank of New York Financial. Currently it's a fairly grown-up organization.
But it's not a real estate organization per se.
No. So our members are drawn from a management consultancy, commercial real estate, the legal profession, the accounting profession, HR, marketing, compliance. If you think about it as the board that you can't afford.
So, oh, I love that.
It's every organization, every single role that might be fit an organization is represented around this table. And so it's really quite something. And I think from a personal perspective, I think it's absolutely great that, individually and collectively, we work together. We have a history of working together. And specifically during times of event-driven change, which is, really what COVID's been about, hasn't it? It's been about sort of resizing, recovering, reimagining where your business is.
It sounds like this network allows you to pivot when some, life-altering change happens and allows you to pivot quickly.
Yeah, yeah. And also, Jan, to be honest with you as well, it provides another channel to market your services. So, probably all of us collectively, we know loads of people who are in real estate, but if suddenly you've got a lawyer and a management consultant and a marketeer who have their own networks, and you've got 10 people in your network, then think how many more potential clients and contacts you have downstream.
It's leverage.
Well, but it's the thing I like about it even more than that, though, is that it's when you are talking to your client and you hear something that they have a need for, you know, people that are trusted already that you can put them in touch with to solve that problem. And that just makes you all the more valuable to your client.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Bob. And I think the other thing is, we meet, currently we meet weekly, but that's because of the sort of hybrid working subgroup that we've been working on for quite a while now. But because we meet regularly, we're actually talking about issues, real-time issues in each other's respective industries. So it's not just a question of saying, I know Bob or Jan in Texas and they do commercial real estate. It's the fact that, you and I might be, we might all be talking to each other and you tell me something specific about your industry that gives me a takeaway that when I'm talking to, X, Y, and Z, I'm informed and I have a degree of understanding as to what's happening in different industries that you can then apply back to your own clients. So I think it's like a It's like anything, isn't it? I always used to say to people, you need to read the financial papers so you know what's happening in the world, you know what's happening in the marketplace. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still going to steal your slogan, the board you can't afford.
Board you can't afford.
That is beautiful. So in COVID times, has the FIDES network changed in any way, or are you guys doing anything differently than you were before?
Do you mean in terms of how we operate?
How you operate, or how you market yourself, or anything else like that?
Well, we've just launched this paper, Where We Work. It's called Where We Work, Where and How We Work Has Changed Forever. And it brings together management consultancy, technology solutions, commercial real estate, workplace and well-being. And it addresses the whole issue of blending home and office working and looks at, you know, how organizations can be more productive, what they need to do. And it sort of melds everything together. And, it's been really exciting working with different people, different viewpoints, not just real estate.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where our focus has been over the last few months, really sort of bringing this piece of work to fruition and publishing it, which we went live yesterday. So officially.
Oh, wow.
Live yesterday.
Congrats.
How exciting. Well, Nick, what have we not touched on that we need to know about doing business in the UK, or just about Nick and who he is as a person?
Well, how long have you got?
Interpaid commercial now.
For my business, I'm passionate about advising corporate occupiers. That's my real interest. I think I probably gravitate more to tenant rep than landlord, because I'm more interested in people. And tenant rep to me is more based on people. It's focused on the assets of a business, and the assets of a business are its people. And I think that's what really floats my boat and what interests me. I just like talking to people. I like finding out about people, what they do, and you know, it just seems much more interesting.
That's interesting you say that, because the first 20 years of my career was representing landlords, and the last 17 have been representing tenants. And I also prefer the tenant side. And it never really quite synthesized for me as to why, until sort of what you just said. On the landlord side, it was always about how people fit into the real estate. And so it was real estate focused, whereas tenant rep is people and company focused, and how does the real estate fit into the company? It's just, they're both involved, but it's just what is the most important piece of it and which is being changed to fit the other. And I like the way you said that, because that clicked for me as to what the difference is.
Well, I'm like you. I started out advising landlords, over 30, I mean, as I said, 37 years now. I've been involved in, I've handled 60 million square feet of office space, which is, just 4 million short of the entirety of the Canary Wharf office market, or 20% of the City of London office market.
Dang, you're old.
I am. Well, I'm not that old.
And successful.
it's a large chunk of space. And I think, over our careers, we've advised startups, one, two-person startups to, organizations which employ thousands of people. This deal I did in January this year with Brian LaFond, who's another ATR member based in Philadelphia.
Yep.
That particular company, employed 10,000, Brian's client employed 10,000 people around the world. It's a big organization. It's terrific when you have that diversity of companies that you can advise, and across a range of sectors. So it's not all financial services. You know, some are sort of creative industries, you know, others are sort of fintech. It's I think it's variety is the spice of life, isn't it?
Yeah, I love that too. I mean, we're doing a deal right now with a client that has hundreds of thousands of employees worldwide based in Asia, and we're handling their lease here in Plano, Texas. But then everybody we're dealing with is in California. And then we have another client who is, the office here is going to be very small, but I was telling a friend about this. It's a Mexican company run by a French CEO, and it's owned by a Spanish company that just bought it from a Swiss company, and they're setting up their first US office. So follow that bouncing ball, and it, you know, it's fun. It's interesting to understand those right. dynamics, and that's what I love about this business. So it's a real fun thing to do every day, and it makes real difference to individuals, to people's lives.
Yeah. And you know, like you, the deal that my deal in January was, you know, Brian and his client based in the States, so Philadelphia, New York, the operational clients in London, the owner of the business is in Paris, the CFO's sat in Geneva, and the lawyers are in Singapore.
Wow.
And, you know, and we're all talking to each other, and we're dealing with each other, and we're either meeting in person or we're meeting, you know, on Zoom. It's just great. I love it.
All I can say is thank God for English. If it weren't for the English language, we couldn't pull this off.
That's quite
Nick,
right.
Thank you so much for being our guest today. We've really enjoyed talking to you. How can people find you online?
Well, my website is mcalmontwoods.com.
And that is spelled McCalmont hyphen. Got to have that hyphen. WOODS.com.
Yeah, that's right. But I'd say it's easier than that because out of the world's entire population of 7.8 billion people, there's only one person called Nick Calmont Woods, and that's me.
I'm sure there's somebody in China.
There isn't. I've checked. So just Google me. Google me. Google my name and message me on LinkedIn. You'll find me.
Well, thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you for having me on your show. It's been a real pleasure.
We enjoyed it. So do you now see why we just love Nick so much?
He's a great bloke.
He's fun. He's interesting. He completely turns my mind totally around the way they do business. It seems so antiquated and strange to me. And yet part of it, I'm like, oh, wait a minute.
Well, it goes back to the feudal system, and that's why it seems so weird to us. But on the other hand, they're ahead of us in terms of who, you know, each party hiring their own broker. And I think that's really smart, and I hope that's what the U.S. gets to someday.
Well, it totally automatically does away with conflict of interests.
Yeah, well, not necessarily, because if you have two people in the same shop, one of whom represents the seller, one whom represents the buyer or tenant landlord, you can still have that potential conflict of interest. Like, you know, because it's Cushman & Wakefield, CBRE, all the biggies are over there. So they can still have that potential conflict of interest like we have here. But the fact that there's not any disclosure issues, I wouldn't think, like we have here where, you know, we're hired by the tenant but paid through the landlord, you know, that's the part that I think is much cleaner.
Yeah, less convoluted.
Yeah. So
thanks for listening to another episode of the Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast. At Riata Commercial Realty, we exclusively serve companies that lease or purchase office and warehouse space. We never represent landlords. Find us at texastenantrep.com or give us a call at 972-667-0028. I read that wrong. That was still on that mock-up wrong. It's 677-0028, but I caught it. read it and then I caught it.
Knowing the problem is half the battle.
See you next. Let me enlighten you, friend.
Goodbye.